is actually writing a book. So I don't think he's running away from Tim Canova at all. I think the question is, you know, when does Bernie go back on the campaign trail? That is not what our revolution will manage. Again, what we will manage and support is are these networks, people that are pushing to reform the Democratic Party, as I mentioned, at the state level, like a Jane Kleb, at the local level, independents, like two candidates running for the Richmond, California City Council, in many cases Democrats, in many cases not. And so, I mean, that's the story here.
And as we have 10 seconds, Claire Sandberg, what will you go on to do, given you've devoted your recent life to the Bernie Sanders campaign and now our revolution before you quit?
Myself and the other people who resigned will fight to continue the political revolution however we can and do the work that we hope to do through this organization in some fashion.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Claire Sandberg, former organizing director for Our Revolution, and Larry Cohen, incoming board chair of Our Revolution. And, of course, we will continue to cover it. This is Democracy Now! That does it for our broadcast. A very special belated happy birthday to Julie Crosby. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Meen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition. Round 2, Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park in Clackamas. This is Round 2 in the Mad Bro Extreme Amateur Games. Winners are allowed to compete in the following competitions and in the final. Again, that's Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition Round 2, Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park, 8921 Southeast Jansen Road in Clackamas. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park in Portland. Swing dance lessons start an evening of live music with breaks included for short informational speeches about the life and history of jazz in the early 20th century. Again, that's Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park between Northeast 11th Avenue and Holiday Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council next week will vote on a 3-year extension of the housing state of emergency.
We'll have a live conversation with Adrian Kabwe of the All African People's Revolutionary Party about the upcoming celebration of Pan-African Women's Day.
And we'll look at the ongoing situation in Turkey, where the government has recently committed ground troops to the war in Syria while cracking down on its perceived enemies at home.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 25th, 2016, and I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Sam Bowman. The Portland Mercury reported today that the Portland City Council will vote on a 3-year extension to the housing state of emergency it declared last October. The current state of emergency ends on October 7th. The declaration has given the city legal recourse to take measures to deal with the city's homelessness crisis. The approach has been attacked by several groups, including homeowners in areas bearing the brunt of homeless camping and housing advocates who want the city to focus on affordable housing instead of shelter beds. As proposed, the new ordinance will change little about this approach. It focuses on mitigating the homeless crisis in the short term, with no mention of affordable housing as a solution. The proposal was brought by the office of Mayor Charlie Hales, and so far he does not have the guaranteed votes to pass it. Three commissioners have expressed doubts about the ordinance, primarily its unheard-of timeline. States of emergency in Portland generally don't extend past 6 months, let alone 3 years. The council will hear testimony and vote on the ordinance next Wednesday, August 31st, at 2 in the afternoon.
Jeremy Patrick Kidwell, a 46-year-old resident of Portland, was arrested yesterday on 3 felony charges of manufacturing a destructive device, possession of a destructive device, and arson in the first degree. Kidwell threw an unexploded bomb underneath a parked RV with people inside of it around Southeast 160th Avenue and Southeast Division Street on Wednesday. The couple living inside the RV said that they had been harassed the past 4 days since parking there and yesterday found what they thought to be a pipe bomb. Upon police investigation, it was found to be an improvised explosive device.
Amidst the current housing crisis, Portland has slid into second place for full-time rentals on Airbnb, right behind Honolulu, Hawaii, with 1 out of every 6 listings qualifying as full-time rentals. This is in spite of the city's requirements that residents live in their homes 9 out of 12 months of the year. According to recent articles in Willamette Week, city laws are often not followed and less than a quarter of the owners have actually had a safety inspection done. With 2,700 active listings in Portland, many argue that Airbnb is taking available housing away from Portland residents and contributing to rising rents. However, Airbnb argues that 15% of these rentals are already commercial properties and would not have otherwise been taking available real estate away from locals.
Opal and Bus Riders Unite are continuing their campaign to persuade TriMet to create a low-income bus fare. Last May, TriMet agreed to look into it. Now the activists are pushing for more progress on the issue. Next Wednesday, Opal plans to attend the TriMet Board of Directors meeting at the agency's downtown offices. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke last night with Angie. Cost of bus passes impacts on families. Find out more about their work at www.opalpdx.org.
Low-income fare equity has a lot to do with the fact that many Portlanders cannot afford the $100 fare. And if this measure gets passed when their TriMet makes a fare electronic rather than through cash, they're proposing getting rid of small passes like day passes and whatnot. So it makes a harder burden for many people who are lower income. So Opal producing a proposal for reduced fare for families is extremely important.
How much can a family end up paying for monthly passes for everyone? Like when you add it all up?
When you add it all up, say a family of 4, and say each of those children live in Outer Southeast. So the oldest child, if they're in high school, they still have to pay for their fare, unlike children in the high school age children in PPS district. So we're talking about let's just round it to $30 per child over the age of 6. You're talking about $90 for the children. If they're talking about a family of 4 with a single mother, $30 for each child, which is about $90, and the parent has to pay $100 for themselves. We're talking about $200 a month. And most people are low income, and on top of that, most of these people are living in places that have high rent, and food is, of course, an issue as well. High rents, high utilities, just high bills. And we're asking, Opal is asking for, at least for the individuals, for the parents, to pay less, a reduced fare.
Is there something specific that our listeners can do to participate in this campaign, do you know?
The easiest thing to do is to go in like Opal and Bus Riders United, and also just share and build awareness in the city. Also put pressure on TriMet for reduced fare by sending emails, especially emails to their office and also call and leave messages to their equity team. This practice of shutting out the public that TriNet has done on a regular basis, shutting out the public and the naysayers about a reduced fare can end if the listeners decide that they won't take it upon themselves to build awareness and pressure TriNet into making a reduced fare.
Angie, let me ask you this. This is my last question. What do you think is the most important thing for this low-income fare equity campaign for people to know about it overall?
The most important is having equity in a city like Portland makes for everyone to have a fresh start, makes for everyone to have a good life and a better quality of life. That's the goal of having a reduced fare. It's for everyone who's affected by having low income to have a better quality of life. That includes young people, that includes elderly, that includes disabled, and that also includes the working poor. They're also feeling a part of the community. They're not being ignored. It is understood that there is some empathy from the city, that we understand your struggle. Here's a leg up. We understand what's going on with you and your family. We understand that people are poor. We understand that people cannot afford the full fare. But now, at this moment, is that complete dismissiveness from TriMet about folks with income struggles.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The Portland Public Schools apparently tried to ban hip-hop music played by its bus drivers, but a leaked document about it has forced a hasty retreat for officials from the troubled district. A memo dated March 3rd of this year has just emerged, showing a transportation manager listed approved music to be played in buses that includes pop, country, and jazz only. The memo written by Transportation Director Terry Brady says, quote, "This list excludes any radio stations that may be in any way offensive to any student riding a PPS bus." The parent who received the memo and publicized it says the memo is racist. District officials yesterday said they are rethinking the policy.
The city of Gladstone says that they are suing Clackamas County over the county's failure to help pay for a new library. City officials are asking for $1.5 million from the famously conservative county government, which some observers have dubbed Clackistan. County officials say they plan to cancel the contract they signed with Gladstone because the city has violated the terms of their agreement. The situation is complicated by the fact that the library money also impacts the nearby town of Oak Grove, which has entered into a new library district with Gladstone. Oak Grove is set to pay almost three-quarters of the cost of the library, while Gladstone pays the rest. But Clackamas County commissioners say that they haven't had enough of a voice in the new facility. Meanwhile, Gladstone residents last year passed a tax to pay for a new city hall and police station. They had already passed a measure to fund the new library, only using library district funding. As KBOO reported last week, some Gladstone residents recently initiated efforts to recall City Councilor Steve Johnson, partly for his combative interactions with the County Commission over the library issue.
The American University in Afghanistan was attacked by bomb-toting gunmen yesterday, but Portland professor Zaire Wahab and his family were unharmed. Wahab is a professor of education at Lewis and Clark, who splits his time between Portland and Kabul, where he teaches at the American University. In a letter sent early this morning to his friends and supporters outside Afghanistan, Wahab says he had just left a meeting at the university when the gunmen swept through the campus. 12 people are known to have been killed in the attack so far, but Wahab writes that he and his wife, Tamina, are unharmed. Wahab spoke on KBOO August 10th with Per Fagering on the show Fight the Empire. He responded to a caller who asked about whether citizens of other countries were being, quote, taught a lesson by the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan.
Of course, it's very different to be there on the ground. For example, to have your colleague either murdered or kidnapped, for example, and to be living and working in a place where you don't feel safe any time, day and night, whether you're in your car or in your bedroom or in your classroom or going from point A to point B. you're always watching, and you always have a bodyguard, and you always have four or five heavy locks on you, a heavy steel door. So that's the kind of life, you know, and you're not allowed to go out, for example. There are restrictions all the time, and things happen all around you. For example, the recent explosion that took place at a demonstration that killed more than 100 people and injured hundreds, that was just about a mile and a half down the road from the university. And also for me to speak the languages and be born and raised there, you know, and I, of course, live in Portland now. I consider this as my country and my town, too. It's very, very painful, frankly. And to see that after 15 years, we have done very little good. Whether you're talking about safety and security, law and order, clean government, good governance, good education, quality health care, drinking water for everybody, work and job and livable wages, a place to live in, you know, a government that can take care of, you know, flooded localities, a government that would bring you the goods and services that a government should. I don't see any of that. I see a parasitic, incompetent, corrupt kleptocracy protected by our tax dollars all the time. But also to see the culture, the vulgarity of the culture, so to speak, from fashions to academic discourse, such as it is, you know, to television programs. So they also have an Afghan television programs like Good Morning America or, you know, something chatty. You know, they have a basket of fruit on the table in the middle and people, it's exactly the same, men and women sitting around. You would think you're sitting in Portland watching an American, you know, ABC.
Do they have a version of Fox News or anything?
Yes, yes, we do. They do. So, you know, I mean, and we haven't developed, you know. Poverty has increased, underdevelopment, you know, schools are closed. People go through the motions of whether it's government or work. Nothing gets done. It's a complete paralysis. You know, the government is, the country's wide open, it's porous, its borders, you know, the government can't guarantee. Planes come and go day and night, actually, without the government either learning sometimes or, you know, trying to control its airspace. So that's what we have done. We have created enormous inequities. You know, there are Afghans who had nothing at one point and now live in very nice homes in Portland. I have to say, if anyone is listening. So this is what we have done, you know, and I think we have just, again, almost destroyed a government as a country, I would say, an illegal, unconstitutional, imposed government on a people who are suffering. So that's all I can say, you know. And many people, actually, even people who are paid by the Americans, like some of our drivers or guards or the staff would say, we wish the Americans would just leave and leave us alone.
The All African People's Revolutionary Party is holding a special celebration this Sunday for Pan-African Women's Day. Here to talk about that is Adrienne Kabwe and Jamila Bourdon. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
First, can you remind our listeners about the AAPRP? What do you do?
Well, what do we do? Well, one of the things we're getting ready to do with several organizations in Portland is open a free school for young people. And it is the School of African Roots. That's one of the major things. And that came out of several projects. But for us, it was the breakfast program, so it's just an extension of that. So that's one thing we're doing. We do work study, which is pretty much the backbone of the work we do, because without political education, then you're going to be ideologically unorganized.
And what was the breakfast club?
Breakfast program. So it was modeled as an example from what the Panthers did. And so they did a free breakfast program as well.
Oh, wow. And what made you organize the Pan-African Women's Day?
African women are leading African revolution all over the world, on the African continent, in the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. Throughout Central America, indigenous African women are leading resistance against imperialist advances and stealing of resources. So all over the world, we see African women leading the struggle for liberation against imperialism, and we want to uplift that work and to center them in the space on Saturday to give them praise and to give them comfort and to let them know that they have a place in this fight.
Great. And Adrian and Jamila, for our listeners who don't know, can you define Pan-Africanism?
Absolutely. So Pan means all. So Pan-Africanism is the concept that, you know, in very simple terms, 20 seconds or less, when Africa is free, all people are free. So there are many resources, for instance, in your cell phone, coltan, which powers your cell phone, which powers your computers. It's in the continent of Africa, aluminum. So many resources we're using don't belong to us. And so we're using a model of organization which will fight for liberation and work towards imperialism, leaving the continent of Africa. And there are many of us around the world. So, you know, people say, well, you know, I'm not African, I'm African American. And so for us, it's not a racial identity, it is a political ideology we're dealing with. And in our organization, in the party, it is a political party. So, you know, folks from Puerto Rico, folks from Honduras, Asians from Honduras, so all over the world, we do not separate. We are all family. So we just come together. We have chapters in the continent of Africa. We have chapters in the Caribbean, in the States, in the UK, all over the world. And we have African Liberation Day, just a model to show the unity politically, the unity ideologically that we have. And so the motto is having a unified socialist Africa. And socialism for us is based on the access to wealth, which is the land. That's where the wealth and the power come from, and the means of production. And so most of us here, all of us sitting in this room and most people listening to this station don't own means of production. And so once that happens, then we'll see a lot of this oppression fall away.
And can you talk about the role of women in the global movement for African revolution?
I just kind of talked about it a little bit. Like mm-hmm. I said, if you look around Black Lives Matter throughout the United States, it's being led by African women, many times queer African women or trans African women. It's the same case throughout Central and South America who are facing imperialist expansion from American corporations who are stealing the resources of people living there. And the people leading the fight against that are African women on the continent. It's the same case. African women are leading organizing, and it's not just like cooking and cleaning. It's like strategizing. It's like leading military strategies. It's like organizing events like this. It's like leading discussions, political discussions, and like and educating their communities. So it's really, really important, we think, to like uplift that work and to show folks just how much African women can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do want to mention that one of the things the AAPRP does, every woman who joins the AAPRP is automatically joining with the All African Women's Revolutionary Union, and 51% of the resources towards the party go towards the AAWRU. And one of the things that we've done in terms of dealing with the issue of patriarchy, which is under the umbrella of capitalism, is men who carry the privilege of being men or identify as men or have the physical bodies of men, so they are required to do a patriarchy group. And so it is the same as our work study process, except they're focused on dismantling patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Who should we be educating ourselves about?
African women revolutionaries and what African revolution actually is, and that it's an ongoing struggle, that if you are a person of African descent, that you are African, you are not African American, you are not Honduran, or you can have those identities as well, but you have to realize that we all come from the same place and our fate is tied to the fate of the African continent. And we are exploited all over the world because the African continent is being exploited. That's what we're trying to let people know. That's what we're trying to like, that's what Pan-African is to us, is to like get folks reconnected to the continent. We were intentionally disconnected from it, so it could be exploited. So we have to come back and save it.
And as you study Pan-Africanism within the AAPRP, what needs do you all see here in the Northwest around African and African-American communities?
Just African, but definitely self-determination. Definitely self-determination, and that's what the goal behind the Breakfast Corps Bank and now the school is. Like, we want to show African folks and the African community in Portland that we can create these resources for ourselves. We have the capacity within our community to educate our children, to feed our children, to keep our community safe without having to involve police that have many times brutalized or murder us. Like, we have everything we need to take care of ourselves and to ultimately succeed in this fight. within our community and within the African community.
And what will be happening this Sunday at the event?
Saturday.
Oh, Saturday. Sorry.
Yeah. What will be happening? Well, we're going to have a panel. We're going to have food. We're going to have positive energy and community spirit. We definitely always welcome the community to these events. And it is a tool of organizing for us. It's not just a tool of socializing. I think that's part of the thing we do in order to get to know each other better. But this work is about organizing because none of us are free. And so it is an educational tool for the community to come in and understand that women have been in the forefront of the struggle. And so many of the films, so many of the seminars, so many books talk about men leading these struggles. And there are so many women. So we're just here to honor the women who are part of the struggle, who are leading it, who are still alive doing this.
And as much as possible, we want to be inclusive of folks who don't necessarily identify as women, but do identify as femme. So you can identify as femme and not be like and not identify as a woman. You could be trans, you can be non-binary. And so we are being inclusive of those folks because it's not just women who identify as women or cis women who are doing this work. It's non-binary folks
Absolutely.
As well. And we're trying to have them as represented as possible because they've been here this whole time and they've our contributions have been erased. And so we're uplifting them as well.
And we have seen where every time the AAPRP does a project or an event, many groups collaborate with you. Who's participating with the Pan-African Women's Day?
Sorry, Pan, one second.
Oh, so this is AAPRP. This is something that is worldwide. So this is not just in Portland. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of things that we do are African Liberation Day and Pan-African Women's Day. And so we definitely do, when it comes to larger issues, collaborate with other groups because that is a highly strategic thing to do. It is scientific, particularly in light of the system oppressing us. We shouldn't be separating ourselves from other groups whose objective is also liberation.
So our panel has folks from the School of African Roots. It has folks from the Nation of Islam. We have a member of PFLAG Portland Black Chapter and Black Lives Matter Portland. So we are trying to connect as many African organizations as possible.
And so that is the strategic part. So yes, it is primarily AAPRP worldwide doing this. But again, yeah, we're working with other groups who are doing liberatory work because that is the only way we're going to get free is working with a mass strategic organizational plan. So, mm-hmm.
And Adrian and Jamila, how can our listeners support your work?
So right now we are fundraising for a chapter trip to Tanzania, Africa. Last year we went to Ghana and it was an incredibly transformative experience. I got to go. It really completely changed the way I approach this work, and we're trying to send the entire chapter this year. We have a GoFundMe that's currently active. Y'all can find it at gofundme.com/AAPRP Oregon. We're trying to send 8 folks to Tanzania, which is pretty expensive, so any donation helps. And you can also, we're always accepting donations for the School of African Roots. We need things like desks and school supplies and heaters. So absolutely message us on our Facebook page, AAPRP Oregon, if you have anything to donate. And we're always accepting donations for our ongoing program. So absolutely get in touch with us.
Great. Thanks, Adrian and Jamila. That was Adrian Kabwe and Jamila Bourdon of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Connect with them online at www.aaprporegon.org. Thanks.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News In-Depth at 5:45, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Guess Who's Coming to Radio with host Jamila Bourdon. For tomorrow's weather in the Portland area, just look outside. There will be a high of 97 and a low of 61, with scattered clouds throughout the day. East of the Cascades and Hood River, the weather will be much the same, but slightly cooler in the day and warmer at night. Today in history, in 1920, Polish forces under General Józef Piłsudski defeated the invading Soviet Red Army at the Battle of Warsaw during the Polish-Soviet War. The 2-week battle was a decisive upset over so far victorious Red Army, halting Soviet expansion into Europe and guaranteeing Poland's eastern border until 1939. Today's birthdays include American surrealist painter Dorothea Tanning, Sean Connery, Regis Philbin, and Ivan the Terrible. The quote of the day is from American humorist Patrick McManus. There is no greater fan of fly fishing than the worm.
It's 5:29, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
An old saying asserts that falsehoods come in three escalating levels: lies, damn lies, and statistics. Now, however, there's an even higher category of lies, a Donald Trump speech. Take his recent address on specific economic policies he would push to benefit hard-hit working families, including an almost hilarious discourse on the rank unfairness of the estate tax. No family will have to pay the death tax, he solemnly pledged, adding that American workers have paid taxes their whole lives and they should not be taxed again at death. But wait, workers are not taxed at death. The first $5.4 million of any deceased person's estate is already exempt from this tax, meaning 99.8% of Americans pay absolutely zero. And the tiny percentage of families who do pay estate taxes are multimillionaires, not workers. Trump knows this, so he's lying, shamefully trying to deceive real workers into thinking he's standing for them when, in fact, it's his own wealth he's protecting. In the same speech, he offered a new child care tax break to help working families, quote, by allowing parents to fully deduct child care costs from their taxes. Trump said that his daughter Ivanka urged him to provide this helping hand to working parents because, quote, she feels so strongly about this. But wait again. 70% of American households don't have enough yearly income to warrant itemizing deductions. So the big majority of Americans most in need of child care get nothing from Trump's melodramatic posturing. Once again, his generous tax benefits would flow to wealthy families like his, giving the richest Americans a subsidy for purchasing platinum-level care for their children. This is Jim Hightower saying, as an early 20th century labor leader noted, figures don't lie, but liars do figure. That fits the Donald perfectly.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
New York City police regularly broke rules regarding surveillance of Muslims after September 11, 2001, according to a report issued Tuesday. The report, issued by the Office of the Inspector General in the New York Police Department, found that police officers often extended the deadlines of terrorism investigations without requesting permission to extend them. Undercover officers and confidential informants were also used without explanation. This is the latest strike against the city's counterterrorism department, following several lawsuits against the city over the department's conduct. The New York Civil Liberties Union described the surveillance of American Muslims as, quote, highly irregular. Police officials said the report vindicated the actions of the department, claiming that each investigation was started for valid reasons. However, the New York Civil Liberties Union stands by its allegations, saying that often there was no valid reason for the surveillance of American Muslims.
Turkish tanks and troops moved into Syria to capture the city of Jarablus Wednesday in its first ground offensive against the self-styled Islamic State. But the Turkish invasion will also deny Kurdish militia from consolidating its gains in northeastern Syria. FSRN's Jacob Resnick explains.
Turkey's offensive began at dawn Wednesday with airstrikes and artillery barrages broadcast by the country's state-run Anadolu news agency. Ankara says its aim is to push back the self-styled Islamic State, which has been shelling Turkish border towns this week and is blamed for a string of bomb attacks. The latest suicide bombing was last weekend in the Turkish city of Gaziantep, where at least 54 people were killed at a Kurdish wedding. By late afternoon, Turkish troops and allied Free Syrian Army fighters entered Jarablus, which has been under the control of ISIS since 2014. Footage uploaded by a Free Syrian Army soldier accompanying Turkish troops shows empty streets. The man taking the video appears nervous. He prays under his breath, though there's no apparent resistance. Ankara says one FSA soldier was killed in the operation. There were no reported Turkish casualties. Turkey is calling its operation Euphrates Shield. It's an apt name, as the primary goal is to keep Kurdish militia from making gains across the Euphrates River. In recent weeks, the Kurdish YPG militia, backed by U.S. airstrikes and special forces, drove ISIS out of the city of Manbij. Washington saw that as a success, but the collaboration angered Turkey, which views the YPG as an extension of the Kurdish insurgency it's been battling since the 1980s. In Ankara, Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim criticized the U.S. for allying itself with Kurdish fighters it considers terrorists, and said his country will never accept a Kurdish state carved from Syrian territory.
Turkey will never accept a new Kurdish entity on the other side of its southern borders. We see this as a substantial threat to our national security.
It's here that Turkey's Euphrates Shield makes strategic sense. Kurdish forces were expected to capture Jarablus from ISIS in coming days. That would have allowed Kurds in Syria to link its two areas of control into a single entity. But with Turkish soldiers and tanks now holding Jarablus, this will drive a wedge between the two Kurdish-held territories. While in Ankara, Vice President Joe Biden said that Washington has told its Kurdish allies they need to pull back from recent gains crossing over the Euphrates River if they wish to retain U.S. support.
We have made it absolutely clear to the elements that were part of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the YPG that participated, that they must move back across the river. They cannot, will not, and under no circumstances get American support if they do not keep that commitment, period.
Now that Turkey has entered the ground war and invaded Syria, it could likely find itself fighting on multiple fronts: ISIS, Kurdish militia, and even the Syrian government in Damascus, which denounced Turkey's incursion as aggression and a blatant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Jacob Resnick, FSRN.
Turkey's escalation in Syria was far from the only topic of discussion during Biden's visit to Ankara. One of the prickliest subjects was Turkish religious leader Fethullah Gulen, who has been in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania since 1999. Gulen's role in Turkish society and politics is complicated and somewhat unique. He leads a religious movement called Hizmet, or Service, which is broadly Islamist but supports science, multi-party democracy, and dialogue between monotheistic faiths. Inside Turkey, Hizmet's influence within the government was underground for many years due to the Turkish state's strict secularism. Then, in 2008, the victory of Erdogan's Islamist party relaxed pressure on the Gulenists. The honeymoon lasted only 5 years. In 2013, a corruption scandal swept Turkey and hit Erdogan's administration particularly hard. Erdogan blamed Gulen and his followers for being part of a global conspiracy against the Turkish state and began to refer to them as terrorists. After the failed coup attempt by elements of the Turkish military in July, the situation has become even more drastic. Erdogan has begun a serious nationwide crackdown on Hizmet, arresting and investigating tens of thousands of people in Turkey for possible connections to a Gulen-led conspiracy. KBU reporter Jamani Ward-Lewis spoke to Tejan İnanlar after the arrests began. İnanlar is the U.S. Northwest Regional Director of the Hizmet-aligned Pacifica Institute.
There are a lot of concerns, of course, in Turkey, and especially since this purge widened to any group who is opposing the government, who is not in the same political view with the President Erdogan, has affected thousands of people, purged from media to university to private sector. And of course, people are feeling insecure. People don't know what will happen. There are news coming from Turkey that are, people are being tortured in the jails, and people are losing jobs. Families are divided. There is, high level of insecurity and concerns that people have at this point. What will their future and also future of Turkey look like?
President Obama has denied Turkey's request for an expedited extradition of Gulen. Turkey claims Gulen is a terrorist and a flight risk, pointing out that he could easily flee to Canada, which has no extradition treaty with Turkey. Gulen's spokesman has claimed that Gulen has no plans to leave the U.S. Biden tried to soothe Erdogan's anger during his visit, but emphasized that the U.S. requires a domestic legal process to determine if Gulen is guilty and should be extradited. Biden requested that Turkey hand over any evidence it has that Gulen is behind the July coup attempt. So far, there is no public evidence that Gulen has had anything to do with it, despite Erdogan's insistence to the contrary.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Thursday, August 25th, 2016. Israeli troops uproot olive trees in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Navy ships attack fishing boats in Gaza and kidnap one fisherman. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli forces on Thursday morning cut down dozens of olive trees in the village of Hawara near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Local sources reported that soldiers destroyed olive trees planted on both sides of the main street under the pretext of use as a cover for Palestinians who throw stones at settlers' vehicles passing on the street. Olive trees, regularly uprooted or cut down by Israeli soldiers and illegal settlers, are greatly valued by Palestinians and considered as a source of livelihood for many of them. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded overnight and on Thursday at dawn, several districts in different parts of the occupied West Bank broke into and searched many homes and kidnapped at least 12 Palestinians. Invasions and kidnappings were reported in Jerusalem City, Ramallah District, in addition to Hebron and Bethlehem cities and nearby towns. In Gaza, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on Thursday at dawn on a number of Palestinian fishing boats in Palestinian territorial waters in the northern part of the coastal region and kidnapped one fisherman. The Palestinian Fishers Syndicate said that one fisher, identified as Abdul Aziz Saadallah, was kidnapped from his boat in Beit Lahia Sea in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. The fisher was in his boat less than 1 nautical mile from shore. His boat was partially damaged by the Navy fire. According to local sources, the Navy attempted to also kidnap another fisherman who was on the same boat, but armed resistant fighters opened fire at the Navy ships, forcing them away from shore and preventing them from confiscating the boat. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, August 25th, 2016 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Maui and me, Vassam Badmura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Theo Burke and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News, found at www.fsrn.org. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio, covering a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, it's One Land, Many Voices. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. Tomorrow, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Pacific Underground, Asians and Pacific Islanders in Oregon taking the mic into their own hands. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. What's that? You're not a current member? Well, you can become one by going to kboo.fm, that's kboo.fm, and clicking on Donate.
Laureen and Rudy Nussbaum were beloved anti-nuclear activists in Portland for decades. Rudy passed away several years ago, and Laureen visited KBOO's Studio 3 to share her stories of growing up under the Nazi regime and her concern that political rhetoric in the United States is beginning to mirror that of the Third Reich before the election of Hitler.
Laureen, we had hoped to interview you about your life, and over the weekend I read a book called The Survival of Laureen and Rudy Nussbaum. The book talked about your experiences escaping the Nazis in Germany and in the Netherlands, and I wanted to ask you questions about that. Is that okay?
Sure. Go right ahead.
At first, I wanted you to describe your early years and your background in Germany and that of Rudy, but that's been covered in the book, and now I find myself wanting to jump ahead to other questions. But I do want to ask, why did you and Rudy decide to do the series of oral histories that resulted in the book? What is the purpose of them?
Well, the book was not our idea. The woman who put it together, Elke Stenzel, is a retired German high school teacher who felt that German youngsters did not have enough material, narrative material, to really put themselves into what happened during the war, during the Hitler time. So she put the book together, the stories of three families, really. One was a